Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three Pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome back to The Big Three. My name is Mark Rader. I'm the senior pastor at Guymere Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we unpack, as you just heard, three big questions that were raised by our congregation coming out of last Sunday's sermon. Our series is Sabbath, Learning to Rest with Jesus. On Sunday, it was the fourth week of that. And returned to the Ten Commandments, something that we looked at in week two. But instead of looking at the Exodus 20 version, we looked at the Deuteronomy chapter 5 version, where there's a slight difference in terms of how they are spoken about. They both speak about keeping the Sabbath day and about who ought to be able to rest, but the motivation is different. In Exodus chapter 20, the motivation for keeping the Sabbath goes back to creation. And in Deuteronomy chapter 5, the motivation goes back to the fact that they had been slaves in Egypt and that God had rescued them. And the point that I tried to draw out as we reflected on the significance of that motivational statement is that God's rescue of his people was not just a rescue from a socioeconomic situation of enslavement into freedom. It was also setting them free from the Egyptian gods who had legitimated and okayed, authorized, shall we say, the system that had enslaved them. Spent a little bit of time talking about how the gods of Egypt stand behind the story in Exodus. They're not spoken about explicitly, but in the ancient Near East, their activity, their presence would have been assumed, and Pharaoh's actions were not just the actions of a rogue politician, but they were the actions of someone who was representing the gods. And so looking then at the fact that God has brought them out from under the people of Israel out from under these other gods who justified enslavement, the Sabbath command then becomes a matter not just of a creation ordinance or even just a command, shall we say, but it actually becomes a matter of idolatry. It actually becomes a matter of who we're going to worship. Are we going to worship the Lord who invites us into rest, or are we going to worship other gods who, well, don't invite us, but drive us into slavery, anxiety, and restlessness? And that was kind of the background to it, which is why I think Sabbath is both so necessary, because it's a matter actually of who we're worshiping, but it's also why it's so difficult. It's not just a matter of time management. It's actually a matter of kind of where do we believe our destiny lies? Who do we believe controls our destinies? Where do we believe the good life is? And then how are we worshiping? And worship being the alignment of our entire lives, our values, priorities, behaviors, and activities and actions to those things that we believe control our destiny. Which is a very, very quick, probably not a great summary. If you didn't listen to the sermon, you can, of course, listen to that on our sermon podcast and get the fuller version, which might make a little bit more sense than that 45-second recap. But nonetheless, it stands behind the questions that were raised this last week. So the first question is this. We explored the gods battling each other. There is the command to have no other gods. Is there evidence of other gods? And that was one of the questions that was most upvoted on Slido. And there was actually a second similar question about, you know, the wars between the gods and there's only one true God, so what gives? So that's certainly a question that we'll tackle. The second question, does the Sunday church service for some clergy and lay people make it difficult for some to observe Sabbath? Which is a question that's been raised personally with me a handful of times over the course of this series. There's an assumption then that the Sabbath is Sunday. And if it is the Sunday, then what does that mean for, you know, clergy or pastors or key volunteers who are heavily involved in the services themselves and might spend 4, 5, 6 hours at church preparing and delivering and whatever the case might be. So we'll have a crack at that one as well. And then the last one is this. We looked at why we should Sabbath, knowing it's a practice we don't often do, and whether it be Sabbath or something else, isn't it enough that God commanded it? And a really good question to wrap up today as we consider our motivation for obedience and faithfulness, and the role, I think, of the law in that as well. So great questions for us to dive into today, starting with one a little bit about the ancient Near East, which I'm certainly looking forward to. So let's get into it. So again, as I said, spent some time trying to the best of my ability in the 20, 25 minutes that I had on a Sunday morning to unpack some of the ancient Near Eastern assumptions about the role of the gods. And so the question that was raised is we explored the gods battling each other. There's the command to have no other gods. Is there evidence of other gods? And as I said, there was a second question that was similar in terms of like, what gives, right? If the Lord is the only true God, then what's all this about? And there's a few things I think that'd be useful to say. First of all, in terms of the evidence of other gods, we would believe that there is, at the very least, right? At the very least, there is the power of and the rule of Satan in the world. Now, his power has been broken convincingly in the death and resurrection of Jesus, but that there is still, the principalities and powers that Paul talks about. Whether we see those as demonic forces or not, the Bible's not particularly clear. I tend to be a little bit suspicious of systems of thought that kind of detail what those principalities and powers are all about. But we would believe that there are principalities and powers. We believe that there are demonic forces that are opposed to God, that instead want to take humanity away from the purposes of God into their own nefarious purposes, their own schemes, and do things for our harm rather than for our good. The Old Testament doesn't really say much about the existence of the gods. It just kind of takes them for granted. If that makes sense. It just kind of assumes that they're there. There's an assumption, shall we say, in the stories that the gods of the surrounding nations are real, but not significant. Probably not the right way to say it. But for instance, there are a number of places, say, during, if you remember the stories of Elijah's reign, Elijah's ministry as a prophet, where, he has the confrontation with the prophets of Baal. They both put out their sacrifice, and the God who answers with fire is the true God. And Baal is proven to be impotent, right? Just cannot bring about the fire to light the sacrifice, whereas Yahweh, the Lord, just devours everything that's there in this display of power. There are a number of places where the gods are described as being nothing or as being worthless, but the gods are still spoken about in that way. And there's lots of places where we see evidence of this in the text. So 1 Samuel 4, the people of Israel are fighting the Philistines. They lose one of their battles, and they basically go back and they get the Ark of the Covenant from Shiloh, where it was at the time, and they bring it into their camp. And the Philistines, we get a report of their response, right? Because the Israelites kind of are jubilant that they have brought the presence of the Lord into the camp to go with them into battle. And the Philistines' response is to freak out. They're like, they've brought a god into the camp. We're in all sorts of trouble now. Be strong, right? And then the Philistines win the battle the next day. Which stuns the Israelites, first of all, and should stun us, really, because the Lord has gone into battle with Israel, but has apparently lost to the Philistine gods. And the evidence that it's the Philistine gods is that, if you remember the story, they take the Ark of the Covenant and they place it in the temple of their god Dagon. Because as far as they were concerned, it was their god Dagon who had won the battle, who had won the victory over Yahweh, the God of the Israelites. And then there's that kind of embarrassing bit when the statue of Dagon keeps falling over and the whole bunch of stuff happens. And finally, the Philistines go, listen, this might be a coincidence, or it might be that the hand of the Lord is upon us, and they send the ark back. There's a passage, I can't remember the exact reference. It's in, it's in 1 or 2 Kings. And the king of Aram is setting traps for the king of Israel. And Elisha keeps telling the king of Israel to be careful. And so he is. The king of Aram has no idea how he's knowing about this until his men tell him that that there's a prophet. So there's the involvement of the gods there. There's another place where the Arameans attack the Israelites on the plains, and Israel wins a victory because God gives them the victory. And the commanders of the Aramean armies basically say, listen, their gods, they won a battle in the hill country. And so the commanders of the Aramean army say, listen, their gods are the gods of the hills, but we can defeat them on the plains. So there's this real sense that the gods are involved in some way, shape, or form. And that's essentially, shall we say, the assumption that lies behind the stories. In a few weeks' time, actually, maybe a month or so, we'll be looking in 2 Chronicles. We're told that Ahaz began to worship other gods because he thought that because of the success that nation had, that those gods would be successful for him too. So this is kind of the assumption of the ancient Near Eastern world. And it's that assumption that we are often a little bit blinded to, because we tend not to think about it quite that way. We tend to, when we think about wars, we tend not to think about the strength of the gods of the various nations. We think about, how much ammunition do they have, and do they have tanks and drones, and is their air force good, and who are their allies? Like, we tend to think about it in a very, I'm going to say, secular kind of way. But in the ancient Near East, and for a great deal of history, there was a sense that the gods were intimately involved in every aspect of life. I've talked before about the covenant that the Lord made with Israel. The short form of that relationship is that I will be their God and they will be my people. And what that points to is that the Lord promises to do the things that the gods were supposed to do. And some of the things that the gods were supposed to do was to go with the armies into battle, and to protect them, and to bring about, fertility, and to bring blessing, right? All those sorts of things. It's the good life, right, which we talked a little bit about as well. So it's not as straightforward as saying that I suppose the gods are real. A New Testament reflection suggests that there are powers out there that may masquerade. As we're told, Satan masquerades as an angel of light. I suppose there may be a sense that they masqueraded as the gods of the ancient world. Some of it may also just have been simple human, the human tendency to try to ascribe meaning and purpose to anything but the Lord. I mentioned that worship is, we worship that which we believe controls our destiny. So if you think about, for instance, the people of Egypt, right? The people of Egypt, it's not that surprising that they began to worship the Nile, because the Nile controlled their destiny, right? The rising and the falling of the Nile River each year was the kind of the source of their prosperity. It was the key to the good life, right? And so it's not that surprising that they began to align their lives and values around the Nile River. Now, again, we think about a river and kind of go, what values does a river have? But when you begin to ascribe to the river, right, those kind of anthropomorphic, those kind of human qualities, right? I don't think it's that big a stretch for us to think, okay, that's why they began to worship something like the Nile, or the power of the sun, or the significance of the stars, or whatever the case might be. So this assumption kind of sits underneath a lot of the Old Testament. It's one of the things that, as I said on Sunday and again today, it's often a little bit hidden for us. But I hope that makes sense for you. And I think for us, if I can kind of jump forward to, I suppose, the application, for us, we need to realize that while we may not anthropomorphize or give human qualities to things like money or power or whatever the case might be, we do worship things, concepts, ideas, right? And we ascribe to them certain powers, right? That money will actually give us security. And it gives us a type of security, but not the kind of security that is really secure. There are a number of things that we ascribe to power or influence, and those contribute to our sense of the good life and the control of our destiny and those sorts of things. So there's still, and whether, I guess the question is whether money is driven by some demonic demon or whatnot. I'm not sure I would go quite that far, but we know that the systems of the world, the powers and principalities that Paul talks about, certainly want to draw us away from faithfulness to the Lord. So again, I hope that makes some sense of that, an opportunity to reflect a little bit on the ancient Near Eastern culture, the background of the Old Testament, something that's often kind of hidden for us. And it does, I think, lead into a few other things that we'll be talking about today as well. The second question is a little bit more Sabbath-centric. Does the Sunday church service for some clergy and lay people make it difficult for some to observe Sabbath? And this is, as I said in the introduction, a few people have asked me about this, about what it would mean for me if we decide as a community of faith that we're going to try to make Sunday, our Sabbath. What would that mean for myself or other members of the staff or some of our key volunteers who, put in a lot of time to be here on a Sunday and to serve? You think particularly of, our kids team who get here early, work with the kids for the hour and a half or whatever it is that we're around, are there afterwards chatting with kids and the families. It's a long stint. I know that they do that because they enjoy it. They think it's valuable and important, but that doesn't mean it's not necessarily work. And I guess I've got a couple of thoughts on this. So the first is, it does assume that we would say that Sunday is the Sabbath. I haven't done a lot where it's been specifically focused on how clergy keep the Sabbath. Although, having said that, a couple of the books were very, I wouldn't say critical, but they highlighted how often clergy are part of the problem, that clergy are like, the work of the kingdom is too important to stop for. And they've kind of questioned that attitude. I suspect that there's a couple things that could be true in that. I think that, one of the authors that I read, Marva Dawn is her name. She teaches, it sounds like they have like an adult Sunday school or something, and she preaches occasionally as well, apparently. And she does not see that as work. She finds that a real joy. And so she is happy to engage with those practices on a Sabbath. Because her principle is that we ought to fill the Sabbath with things that are restful and life-giving, not necessarily just kind of stopping everything that we might normally do. So I suppose there'd be an element to say that, say part of my role on a Sunday, which I really enjoy. I really enjoy preaching. I really enjoy teaching. That might be, I resonate with Marva Dawn about that, to kind of go, yep, I see that as light labor. I don't see that as a heavy responsibility, but something that's really quite enjoyable. But I think there's also space for clergy and others who are heavily involved in the life of the church to make sure that there are other times when they are resting. I've mentioned this before. I've been fairly disciplined over the course of my ministry career at keeping a day off. The majority of my ministry life, it's been Thursdays. So Thursdays is the day that I'm just not at work. I am not at college. I'm not here at the church. And, there's been a few times when things have been hectic and I've had to come in and do a little bit of work, or when there's been a conference on that's kind of gone over onto the Thursday, and I'm more than happy to kind of adjust in those spaces. But I've been pretty disciplined about doing that. And so I think, when I pitch forward to thinking about what Sabbath keeping might look like, a lot of my thought personally has been about what a Thursday might look like for me, rather than a Sunday. Because there is an element of Sunday that's work-related. It's, if I can put it this way, it's one of the days I get paid for in that sense. It's one of my five work days. And there is, you know, I'm here quite a bit. I've got meetings on Sundays, all those sorts of things. And so I'm not sure that I could keep Sabbath on a Sunday. The other thing I'd say is I'm not sure what Jews think about this. In the sense that, you know, I know that the Jewish traditions have done a lot of thinking about what this might look like. And obviously, for Jews, attending synagogue was, well, it wasn't just allowable, it was a good thing to do. Like, that's when synagogue was. Like, you went to synagogue on the Sabbath. And the rabbis would have taught on the Sabbath. And I don't know how they handled that. I don't know what they saw as work, and how that would, how those things would play out. You know, Jesus taught on the Sabbath and that seemed to be okay. Wasn't deemed to be work. Maybe it's because he was teaching the law. If he'd been teaching carpentry, maybe that would be work. So I'm interested to know, how Jewish tradition deals with that question as well. I think another group of people for whom Sabbath might be difficult, just while we're talking about the difficulty of Sabbath, would be shift workers. Again, I'd be interested to know what Jewish traditions have to say about shift workers whose shifts may or may not line up every week, who may not be able to keep a Sabbath as regularly. You know, they might be able to keep a Sabbath somewhere between a Wednesday and a Thursday because they've always got an evening or a morning or a day free. But I think there are some groups like that. Emergency services or essential services, I think, would also fall into that category. So there are a few places where it's tricky, and it's where we want to avoid, if we can, we want to avoid legalism in that space. So again, you know, I think that there's some really good thoughts in that, like some really good insights from that question for us to be thinking through. And again, I reckon that the bottom line is we have to avoid that legalistic, it has to be this, not that. We need to be people who are able to keep the Sabbath and to find ways to do that. I do reckon that one of the challenges for us is that our world resists stopping. Although, as one author put it, it's ironic that it's banks and the stock market that are, you know, some of the few places that actually stop on the weekends. You know, but we need to find ways in which we can find rest and stopping. And our world just doesn't have the guardrails that it used to. You know, 20 years ago when everything was closed, or 30 years ago when everything was closed on a Sunday, there it was a little bit easier. So we do face some unique challenges in that space, but I don't think they're challenges that cannot be overcome. But again, we're a little bit light on our applications. We're continuing to think that through as we go. But let's turn to the third question. Our last question for today is this. We looked at why we should Sabbath, keep the Sabbath, and knowing it's a practice we don't often do, and whether it be Sabbath or something else, isn't it enough that God commanded it? And I suppose, you know, earlier this year in our January series, I cited Reverend Timothy Lovejoy from The Simpsons when asked a difficult question, and his answer was, yes with a but, no with an and, or something like that, no with a maybe. You know, there's a little bit yes and no in this. Because God's commanded us to do something, should that be enough? Yeah, it probably should be. Like, it probably should be. And it's important, I think, for us to remember the purpose of the law. I think that might be a helpful thing. God's desire in giving the law was ultimately that his people might become lawless. The hope that we see in the Old Testament that's fulfilled, particularly in the pouring out of the Holy Spirit, is the intent that the law be written on their hearts, right? That the law be written on their hearts in such a way that they no longer need the law in order to live the right way. And I've got a couple of examples and illustrations that I commonly use in relationship to this. One is the difference, and we've all experienced this, that there's a task that if we are told to do it is just heavy labor. But if we choose to do it, time flies. My example goes back to being a kid and cleaning your room. If I was told to clean my room, like you're cutting corners and you're kind of doing the bare minimum to kind of be able to go outside and play again. But there were times when I would decide for some random reason that I was going to rearrange my room. And so you'd dump everything out and you'd move everything around and you'd replace everything and you got fully into it because it was something that you had desired to do. That was what God intended. He never intended the law to be something that pushed us, but instead that the law would be something that would, from our hearts, push our actions out of our hearts, that we would be acting in a heart response. The other example that I use is of seatbelt laws. Right now, if they repealed the seatbelt laws, right, this afternoon across Australia, new Act of Parliament, you could no longer enforce seatbelt laws. Tomorrow morning, without the law, I would still nonetheless put my seatbelt on because I have internalized the value and benefit and purpose of those laws. And I no longer see them as impinging upon my freedom or anything like that. I recognize that wearing my seatbelt will save my life if I'm in a car accident, or could save my life if I'm in a car accident. I just recognize the value. And to some degree, I no longer require that law. They could repeal it and I would still keep it. And this is, again, what God requires of what God's hope for was his people. So the idea of meditating on the law of the Lord was not just to memorize it, it was to internalize it, to be talking about the laws all the time and to write them on the doorposts of your homes and to talk about them with your children and to write them on the palms of your hand and on your forehead. Like, it was a matter of trying to internalize the law of God to such a degree that we would actually respond from our hearts, right? Internalizing God's law. And I think the Sabbath law, if it were internalized, then sure, that would be more than enough for us. That would be more than enough for us because we would have internalized that sense. But we often, I think, tend to see the law as an external push. And sometimes that's how it begins, right? When seatbelts were first brought in and legislated. I'm pretty sure it took people a long time to get used to putting them on. I'm sure they felt uncomfortable, that there was a sense that, do we really need these? That there would have been some resistance around them, right? But over time, as people practice it and it's then reinforced and enforced, it becomes internalized because people kind of get it, right? And I think the Sabbath law, all of the laws of God, kind of function the same way. So in the New Testament, the Holy Spirit is writing those laws on our hearts. And we are those, Paul says, who are not under law anymore. And that's not because we've become anarchists. It's because the Holy Spirit is writing those laws on our hearts that we no longer need to be told what to do. I've used the example before that, when the Lord returns and we're all in glory and the new heavens and the new earth have been done and there's kind of the big celebration and there's this kind of silence, and I'm assuming Jesus stands up and kind of says, there's a couple of announcements to make, right, before you head into eternal glory. He's not going to start with a bunch of laws, because we will then be transformed and will no longer need to be told what we should or should not do, because we will have been perfected. That life is the life that has begun for us as followers of Jesus. And so the process of having those laws internalized is part of our journey as followers of Jesus. So should the law be enough? Should the command of God be enough? Yes. Yeah, broadly speaking, absolutely. God said it, we should do it. Fine. But we tend to be unwilling to do that, don't we? When it comes right down to it, we end up with a bit of a heart problem, right? We require the command of God. And I think to that extent, sometimes it is very helpful for us to recognize the value of God's laws. I would never want to lose sight of the fact that God has commanded us to keep the Sabbath, and that that ought to be a motivation for us. But I also think that the ways in which, say, the laws are formulated for us do provide us with a couple of additional places for us to reflect, right? So Moses's spin on the fourth commandment, changing the motivation from creation to freedom from slavery and freedom from the gods of Egypt who authorized that slavery. In the one command that is starkly different from those around you, to recognize and to remember that this law is not just a random law, but that this is a law that is reflective of the very character of God, and one of the things that marks him out, one of the things that sets his kingdom apart from the kingdom of the world. And so I think the way in which the commands are framed up invite us to consider the wider motivation, to consider the wider issues that are at stake, and that the commands that God has given are not, they're not just commands. They're a description of the kind of life that we ought to live. They are, they're the characteristics that we ought to reflect. And that, I think, helps us take a law like the Sabbath, which in many regards seems to have no place in our world, just has no place in our world right now. The idea of stopping and resting just seems not just counterintuitive, it just seems, well, just seems impossible. And so the idea of reflecting more broadly, right, I think is quite valuable for us to recognize that what we're engaged in is not just the obedience to a command, but is also reflective of the God whom we follow, right? Not just God as he expresses his plans in the Old Testament, but more specifically in the person of Jesus. And that, I think, helps us shift from a response of duty to a response of delight, right? Where we are engaged in obeying the laws of God, not just because we ought to, although there's a time and a place to just do what God's commanded us, and I think that that's part of our response, but also to move toward that sense of, no, this is actually a delightful thing. This is the light and easy yoke that we have been offered. This is the rest that we are given. This is the jubilee that Jesus represents for us. So a great question to help us think through, you know, the role of the commands and what it means for us to be following after God and after the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's the Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of the Sabbath, that we're going to be looking at this coming Sunday as we wrap up this series, finally turning to the New Testament and what Jesus has to say about the Sabbath and how that might shape and impact the way in which we study, reflect that in our lives. So I'm hoping that you can join us on Sunday, both online and on site. It'd be great to have you be a part of that and to have you join me again next week for the Big Three as we continue to figure out what it means to love and follow Jesus. Until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.